Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
I'm Mike Shackelford.
Our guest tonight is award-winning gambling author Michael Koenig, who is here to talk about his brand new debut novel, Becoming Bobby. We'll be chatting with him shortly. For several weeks, I've been urging all of you who belong to VP Free to vote for Ernie Moody to be elected to the Video Poker Hall of Fame. I'm happy to say that the results were announced this past Saturday and Ernie won. I'm not sure if it was because of my efforts or in spite of them, but congratulations, Ernie, anyway. Thank you to all of you who voted for him. Both Shaq and I are members of this Hall of Fame, and we heartily welcome Ernie to our midst.
You're here. Despite the fact that Ernie is an extremely wealthy man, he's very friendly and down to earth, and he's done a lot for video poker players, both professionals and amateurs alike. For the professionals, there are more games to choose from, and oftentimes the best game in a casino is one that Ernie invented. And for everybody, his games are just fun and make video poker more enjoyable.
Agreed. I received an email addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com concerning the difference between full-time advantage players and part-time advantage players. I'd like to touch on part of that tonight. For tonight's discussion, I'm going to assume that the part-time player is a non-local relative to the casino he's going to be playing at, and that he comes to town to play several weekends a year. There are a large number of other possible scenarios, but that's the one I'm going to be talking about tonight. First of all, the key element to advantage gambling remains. That is, if you don't have the advantage, don't play. That's true whether you are a full-time advantage player or a part-timer. Second, for part-time players, you're usually going to have to let other people do your scouting for you. Smart full-time players spend a portion of their time scouting. But if you're only in town 30 hours or so every 3 months, there's little time for this. Often relevant information is posted on websites. For video poker, this would be VP Free, videopoker.com, and the database VPFree2.com. Blackjack players know the websites dedicated to their games. The best opportunities, however, are usually not posted. Whoever finds them first often tries not to let anybody else know, because the more people know about a good opportunity, the harder it is to get a seat, and the more likely the casinos will be to remove the game. Third, part-time players need to spend proportionally more time studying, simply because they forgot some fine points since their last trip. A full-time player plays the same game over and over again, so finds it easier to keep the strategy memorized. But if you haven't played for 3 months, you may not remember everything. There are different bankroll considerations. Most full-time players are trying to support themselves through gambling, and most part-time players have outside income. Losing your bankroll is a very big deal if you're a full-time player. It's not such a big deal if you're a part-time player who has the resources to replenish the bankroll. Part-time players play for different promotions. At the Palms, for example, they have drawings on weekend based on your play since last Saturday night. If you just get to town Friday evening, you're totally missed the Friday drawing and have a relatively small chance in the Saturday night drawing because other people have been playing all week. In a similar vein, often you earn drawing tickets in a casino for a drawing that will be held in, say, 2 weeks. If you can't get back to town, the tickets are worthless to you. There's a Palms promotion this month that would fall into this category. In addition, full-time video poker players play to get a monthly mailer. Part-time players have a totally different sort of set of parameters. They aren't going to be here to pick up mailer money weekly, and out-of-towners are interested in a suitable room and meals and possibly airfare. Some casinos will give you money just to show up. I don't know the specifics of how much play various casinos want in Las Vegas, you know, to give you this money. I do know certain casinos in other parts of the country, what they want, because when I'm there, I'm a non-local, and I make it a point to find out these things. Out-of-town players should cash out their slot club dollars at the end of every trip. Even though they're planning on coming back every 3 months forever and ever, amen, they can never know for sure what's coming up that might prevent them from returning. You don't want $200 in slot club cash 300 miles or 3,000 miles away, and if it's inconvenient to go there. Locals don't have the problem. Even if they don't want to gamble anymore, traveling 20 miles or less to pick up slot club cash isn't usually an insurmountable problem. Part-time players can keep their welcome in casinos longer than full-time players can. If you keep winning at a particular casino, eventually the casino will no longer let you play there. Full-time players have to keep going back to the same places over and over and over again, and they'll get kicked out faster because they become recognizable to the casino management. Now, that's enough for now. Maybe I'll revisit this subject in a week or two and add some more points. Michael, do you have anything on this subject?
I agree with everything you said, but two advantages to being a part-time player that doesn't live locally is that I get free room offers all the time, and I never use them because I already live here. But people that live outside of Vegas could actually use these free room offers that they're getting. And I don't have so much direct experience with this as a video poker player, but I strongly believe that locals get the short end of the stick when it comes to their own casinos, and that tourists just simply get treated better.
Very good. Well, we have Michael Koenig on the line, so we are going to start. We're going to talk to him. Michael Koenig has done everything. He's been an actor, an improv stand-up comedian, a big sports bettor, a poker player, a television commentator, a jazz musician, a highly successful magazine columnist, and an author of 7 nonfiction books. Maybe he even knows how to cure baldness. I don't know. Tonight, we're going to be talking about his first fiction book, Becoming Bobby. Michael Koenig, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you, Bob. And have I mentioned my new product? It's called Grow Your Hair.
Grow Your Hair. Well, Shaq and I have a $1 bet on how you pronounce your last name. It's spelled K-O-N-I-K. I think it's Koenig, and he thinks it's Koenig. Do you have a preference, or do you answer to both?
I answer to both, but Bob, I would say you are $1 richer.
This gambling is great. I love this. All right. Now, the main character of your book is an unnamed nobody, or maybe an unnamed everyman, who hates his life, especially his wife, and his humdrum job. He has this overriding vision that if he could only become Bobby, his life would be perfect. This book is about the anti-hero pursuing this dream and actually becoming Bobby. First of all, who is this main character based on, if anybody?
Bob, I really like the way you described the book. I need to learn to describe it just as well as you did.
Well, done. Maybe I'll get a dollar from him, too, for this service. This is great. All right, go on.
The main character was based on three powerful influences. One, my father, who I always saw as a deeply dissatisfied, discontented guy who never felt like he realized his full potential. I based it also on my prism of things that I muse about all the time. And even with that impressive-sounding CV that you rattled off, there are indeed times when I think everybody else, wonders, is this what I am going to be doing with my life? Is this the life that I'm going to have? Is this what I really dreamed of? I think we all ask ourselves that question, so you can put me in there as well. And then the other part was a lot of just angry, dissatisfied, bitter, middle-aged men that I have met throughout my life, and it's dozens of them. It's just it's not a type of person so much as an energy, and I wanted to try to see the world through those three prisms simultaneously, and that's how I came up with the narrator.
All right, and you did that well. And a follow-up question, is there any particular Bobby you had in mind as this perfect person?
No, I didn't. When I was writing it, I didn't. I wanted to do it in an elliptical enough way so that every reader could fill in his or her own Bobby.
All right. Let me say that I'm a big fan of yours. I don't think I've ever met you, but I've read all your gambling books, and I'm always praising The Smart Money and really enjoyed the other ones too. And I thought this book was great. I have not finished a book in English in probably at least a year, but I had a hard time to put this one down.
Well, thanks. How does this stack up against all the Chinese and Spanish books you've been reading?
I can't read any Chinese books, but I try to read a fair number of Spanish books to improve my Spanish. But my question is, becoming Bobby seems to fictionalize every place, person, and all other proper nouns, although sometimes the references are fairly obvious. Was this done out of a fear of a libel suit or an alternative reality effect or some other reason?
It was not done for fear of libel. It was done partially as an alternative reality, but it was also done as satire of things that are so embedded in our consciousness through popular culture that we all recognize them no matter what we call them.
Very interesting.
Your hero is delusional. His own perceptions are clearly at odds with the perception of everyone around him, and your prose makes this very clear. Do you believe this is true of most people, that they're delusional?
I think that we all live in our individual illusions. And delusional then is based on just where your illusion is coming from. So I'm not going to go so far as to say that we're all delusional, but I'll say that those that we recognize as delusional may in fact just be having a different illusion than we are.
Okay.
Do you think that we're all more depressed than we think we are, or?
Man, I feel it. You know, I feel the energy. The older I get, the more uncomfortable I am being around people who radiate unhappy energy. And I'm generally a happy guy, and I find life interesting, and even when it's not a happy time, I still think it's a beautiful journey to be on. And being around those who apparently don't feel the same way about life
is a drag.
Has made a strong impression on me. Yeah, and so I don't know, man. Maybe we are more depressed than we acknowledge. I feel it. I feel it, and I feel it from everyone who isn't the fabulous, glamorous, sexy, rich, powerful, celebrated life changer that society tells us we ought to aspire to be.
Well, that's a very profound answer. And the question I was planning to ask was, you have a very descriptive way of writing, as if you're writing about your own life. For example, the main character in the book had a job selling ads in obscure trade magazines, and you paint a very detailed picture of what that was like. Do you have any personal experience in such an occupation?
I don't. I have a little bit of experience of working in a soul-killing corporate office, and I do have some experience working in custom publishing, but I never actually had to sell ads to arc welders and cranberry farmers.
All right. Now, halfway through the book, your hero rids himself of his job and his wife and heads for the Nirvana Hotel and Casino in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And the Nirvana is an over-the-top exaggeration of top-notch casinos in Las Vegas, based very loosely on casinos such as Wynn, Bellagio, Venetian, Cosmopolitan, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The description doesn't match any of them exactly, yet it accurately describes them all.
Mm.
I especially like the description of the DOD, which is the, which is the delivery of delights.
Yeah.
This program allowed a platinum member to order up his choice of one or more beautiful companions who were all too willing to do whatever this platinum member wanted done to his member. That's the best I can do on radio. I was never a big enough player to qualify for any DOD services. Now, how much of an exaggeration was that intended to be?
It was supposed to be an exaggeration that feels plausible, but makes you, at the end of the day, have a good laugh. You know, we all look at RFB and like, well, what's the next step beyond RFB? Well, man, those guys who get all those ringside seats at the fights and the limos. And then, well, what's beyond that? Well, you know, the guys that they give a whole floor of the casino, of the hotel to. Yeah, and what's beyond that? Well, you know, the guys who they snap their fingers and they can have a 16-year-old boy. You know, this is the thinking that goes into the casino status system, and I just tried to take it to what struck me as a
logical conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. The characters in your book perpetuate many of the same gambling myths that I've been trying to debunk for 15 years now. Let me read a passage referring to slot machine placement for your response.
Okay.
And all the way there, we drove sometimes 14 hours through the plains, eating at truck stops, loving the freedom. My wife would talk about her crazy theories. The primary one, the one that I recall producing the largest cascade of nickels, involved machine placement. The only thing that really mattered was where a machine sat in relation to high traffic areas. Near was good, far was bad. According to my wife, machines on the ends of rows, particularly rows that abutted a major walkway through the casino, were set to pay out more than the one squashed into the interior. The outside machines attract attention, my wife theorized. They're like advertisements for the other machines. People see and hear these machines paying off like gangbusters, so they sit right down, except all the other machines. She would also pause dramatically at this point in her tutorial, are set to pay out less. Loss leaders, I would say blithely, tossing off salesman lingo. So if you only play the outside machines, the ones near entrances and where people pay attention, my wife would continue, ignoring me. Well, then you're going to win more. She would shrug emphatically as if to say, simple, see, and encourage me to drive a little faster. So I've heard this theory so many times, but you say it so well. And my question is this based on any particular person you've heard saying this, or is it just chatter you've heard through
times.
The years?
It's somewhere between one and a million, but Yeah, it's an omnipresent thing. I somehow feel like I heard it at the Binion's coffee shop back when they used to have that during the World Series of Poker, when they had the
$2 steak specials.
Yeah, that place. And I think that's the last time I heard it told to me with great conviction. But yeah, I've heard that one a number of times, and man, I'm glad that I could boil it down to its grand essence.
And if, and lest anyone be confused, that's absolutely a myth.
What?
Yes.
What are you saying?
Oh, well, please sit down, Koenig. Don't fall over out of shock. So, our hero gets extremely lucky early at the Nirvana, although he believes his luck on the slot machine is due simply because he has finally become Bobby. Mm-hmm. Our hero meets a variety of gamblers who share very bad gambling advice with him about winning strategies at gambling, including slot machine selection, roulette, craps, and blackjack. As Shackelford did, I found this part of the book very realistic. Everybody thinks they have the secret to winning and want to share this with others. Few people actually do possess this knowledge. I thought your description was nails on, and the other knowledgeable gamblers will nod when they read this and go, yep, that's exactly what it's like. Now, do you have any concern that somebody not particularly knowledgeable about gambling will read the book and say, Michael Koenig is a very famous and sharp gambling writer. If it's in his book, it must be true.
Bob, this concern had not occurred to me.
Ah. This radio show is providing a service to you to help you think of things you didn't know yet.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. I mean, it seems to me that a narrator, no matter how emphatically he states it, one who says, you know, I'm a winning slot player because I listen to the machines better than everybody else. I heard the ones who needed my attention. This is probably not someone a rational person would follow for gambling tips. But if they do, who knows? Maybe they'll win too. Maybe it really is all about becoming Bobby. And maybe we math guys have been telling ourselves a comforting lie all these years.
You know, that's what my uncle would say is I watched him play video poker once, and he was just playing terribly. And I the same thing with blackjack. And I tried to teach him the strategy to both games, and I never got very far. And he said, Mike, if I played like a robot like you, it would take all the fun out of it.
It would be like a job.
Yes.
And he's right. It would take the fun out of it for him.
Yep. Okay. In another chapter, the main character is having a conversation about blackjack with his friend Max, who has a much better understanding of the game. It goes like this. Bobby, he says solemnly, what do you know about blackjack? Well, I know I'm probably not as good at it as I am at the slots. That's for sure. I'm joking, but I'm serious. I mean, do you understand the game, the principles of it? What does he take me for? Someone who's never been to the desert? Of course I do. I do, Roger. You try to make 21 without going over. So, I always want to pull my hair out when I hear people say that. The object of blackjack is not to make 21, but to beat the dealer. So my question is, did the Bobby character ever say anything accurate about gambling in this whole book?
I don't think so, but you might be able to find something. I mean, you've read so carefully and seen the truth so obviously that you sort of caught on to my little trick there, which is, I don't think he says anything that a gambling expert would agree with.
So, this Roger Mack character, who is a competent blackjack player. Maybe he cheats. We don't really know because we only see Roger through the delusional lens of our hero. Now, our hero becomes a big player where Roger Max is betting small and signaling the correct play. And our hero is a good big player because the casino has accurately assessed him as a total sucker, which he is. Now, is Roger based on any particular blackjack player or team that you know?
Yes, and he is a composite.
Okay, so a lot of different teams, a lot of different big player kind of situations. Okay?
Yeah, I mean, I had a couple of people in mind who made a strong impression on me in how they looked at the casino world and what they thought of casinos in general. And it's not based on a single particular person, but certainly people that I think professional gamblers would recognize.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps do in the character.
Okay. The main character in your book also falls victim to the gambler's fallacy. Let me read a passage about that. Holy bleep! Either this little white ball has a fetish for dark meat. Let me back up by saying that he had just observed the ball landing in black in roulette 8 or 9 times in a row. So he says, either this little white ball has a fetish for dark meat, and who doesn't occasionally, or I've just waded into a sure thing money-making opportunity, and that's not something most people accustomed to losing in and out of the casino, in their workplaces and in their lives, have the vision to recognize. I'm no math genius, but I do know this. If a roulette ball comes up black 9 times in a row, it's almost a moral certainty that it will come up red on the next spin. I mean, the laws of probability have to catch up with reality, end quote. So again, you capture the mathematically ignorant mentality of many gamblers perfectly. Was this book based on any one person or just observations made of recreational gamblers through the years?
The latter, yeah. You know, if you spend too much time at casinos, as I did for a period of my life, you hear every theory, every hypothesis, and every wrong-headed approach that there is under the sun. And some of them, if framed correctly, actually are sort of funny. And I found this one pretty funny.
Yes, I've given up trying. You know, there's always a debate on my forum about the gambler's fallacy, and I just don't even participate anymore. I've just thrown my hands up in the air. I give up. There's no convincing anyone who believes in it of the truth.
Yeah.
Well, hey,
actually,
again,
I would have thought the gambler's fallacy would have been to kept betting on black. To switching to red, I would think would be a reverse gambler's fallacy, isn't it?
Well, I think they're both. That's the beautiful thing about the proposition. I could have written the scene the other way, and I think it would have come off just about the same.
Yep.
Yes, it's funny that in baccarat people think the trend will keep going, but in roulette people think that the trend is bound to break.
Mm. Oh well. That sounds like another gambler's fallacy. All right.
Yeah.
Now, I suppose your book could be called a dark comedy. Without describing the ending further tonight, I personally was surprised by the ending, especially the last paragraph. Although I very much enjoyed the book and recommend it to others, I found I was in a sad and introspective place when I finished. As an author, did you intentionally take your readers to a dark place?
It did intentionally take them to a dark place. My hope was that in this darkness, the final note that one walks away with is hopefulness and perhaps a sense of melancholy contentment. That's what I was trying to do.
I think you made it.
Well, thank you. Thanks. Dark comedy, I think, is accurate. The darkness in this book, I think, is real and is so dark that, to me at least, it crosses into humor. But throughout it, I'm hopeful that everybody who reads it will see something of himself or herself in the narrator. And as the last paragraph suggests, he was in search of something throughout the book, and we understand how he feels about that search.
So what are the odds of a sequel?
I'd say about zero, but one never knows, do one.
Well, what if this one sells 10 million copies?
I would be the most surprised human being on the planet.
Well, I don't know. There was a popular book and movie called Becoming Bobby Fischer. So your book is called Becoming Bobby, so clearly you're two-thirds of the way to being a bestseller.
Hey, man, maybe I can get some of the mistaken click syndrome.
That's
customers.
It. Now,
yeah.
Is there any connection between the Becoming Bobby Fischer book and Becoming Bobby?
None whatsoever. No. Is Becoming Bobby Fischer... Wait, was that about the 12-year-old boy?
I think so.
Yeah, that's interesting. I actually used to play chess with that kid when I was going to NYU, and his dad would bring him to Washington Square Park. I actually lived on Washington Square Park. But enough about somebody else's book.
All right. So, Michael, give him a question about his book.
Yeah. No, but it's interesting you say about the sequel. I don't think so. I said what I wanted to say about some really heavy things in this book, including my many years spent in the Las Vegas casino culture, which I'm not a part of anymore, and I look back on it as a very rich chapter in my life, but not one that I really have that much to say about anymore. I feel like this is sort of my valedictory statement on the gambling world. And I take it as high praise from cats like you that so much of the scenes that take place in the desert struck you as spot on, because I was trying to get to what the real, true essence of the Vegas casino culture is about. And that's about all I have to say about it, Bob.
Okay.
I think the movie was In Search of Bobby Fischer.
Was it?
Thank God.
I'm not positive, but I would lay 2-1 on it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I would take your side.
Well, I did Google Becoming Bobby, and the other one came up too. So It's possible that the book was titled one thing and the movie was titled something else.
I think it's possible that some wily web pirate saw the immense literary potential of Michael Koenig's new novel, Becoming Bobby, and thought, I better get a cheap imitation up there on Amazon right away.
Well, Shackelford's trying to lure me into a bet so he can get his dollar back, which, by the way, he has already paid off. All right, so do you have another question, Shaq?
Well, I asked all the ones that I wrote, but
I have some more.
Okay, I would like to say that... I was so depressed after reading your book that I had a driving need to watch It's a Wonderful Life to cheer me up.
Oh,
again.
That's sweet.
And fortunately, it was really the Christmas sweet. Season.
All right. So
I want to ask you a question. Was that sense of depression after you had finished the book, or was I hope it wasn't like how you felt from start to finish? Was it?
The feeling I felt the second half was more depressing. After he left his job and his wife, I was really hoping that things would go really well for him in Vegas.
Oh, but they did. They went wonderfully well.
Maybe I had
He's platinum, man. Platinum.
Didn't you read about the DOD?
Yes.
But and nevertheless, he won money. But still, even though he was. He got his platinum status and he won lots of money. I don't know. Somehow I still felt that he was unfulfilled.
Well, I think you ought to read the last paragraph again. Okay. Now, is your next book likely to be fiction or nonfiction?
I think it's likely to be fiction, Bob. I've actually written two more novels, and my agent's in the process of trying to find people who still want to publish them. I'm really interested in fiction right now. I feel like I have lots of freedom. I feel like I have permission to be imaginative, and I feel like I can tell stories that maybe are even more real than the true stories I used to tell.
What are some of your other fiction books?
This is it so far.
Oh, I thought that published. In the introduction you said that he had other ones.
He has seven nonfiction books.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, right.
And he's been on, yeah?
In my previous book to this, a book about marijuana called Reefer Gladness, there are several short stories, short fiction in there. This is my first full-length fiction, but this is where I feel I'm going, and I'm having great fun doing it. I already have, as I said, two others ready to go, and they're nothing like Becoming Bobby, and I love them very much.
Now, Becoming Bobby was published by Anthony Curtis. It's Las Vegas Advisor, Huntington Press. They have a fiction segment called Vegas Lit, which is run by Arnold Snyder, and so this was the second book in that series.
Yeah.
Are they likely to publish your third or your next one, or do you have any idea?
Well, my understanding is that Vegas Lit is looking to publish fiction that is either Vegas-based or risk and reward-based, things that are sort of a natural fit for Huntington Press. And let me just back up and say Arnold Snyder did a sensational job of editing Becoming Bobby. This is my eighth published book, and Arnold is as good or better than any editor I've worked with, and that includes, you know, Simon & Schuster and McGraw-Hill. I was very impressed with the work he did. He had a strong hand in helping make this book as good as it is. So I do hope to work with him again. I previously had only known him as the prolific author.
Yes.
And was not aware of what a beautiful editor he was. And now I know.
What kind of things do you publish on your website, michaelkoenig.com?
Every Sunday I publish a Thought of the Week, which is an essay about something that usually in the news or something that I'm thinking about a lot. And then every Tuesday through Saturday, I also publish a Thought of the Day taken from 8 years of archived and searchable essays. I would generally describe the essays as provocative, funny, no holds barred, rude, interesting, and deeply invested in trying to describe things the way they really are.
Very good. So, Michael Koenig, we want to thank you for sharing part of your evening with us. You're one of the gambling writer royalty, and we appreciate you you coming on our show.
Guys, it has been such a pleasure, and I appreciate the closeness and care with which you read Becoming Bobby. It really means a lot to me, and I'm delighted to hear your comments and questions about it. Really makes me happy. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Michael.
So, Michael Shackelford, what did we learn tonight?
Oh, well, we learned that every bit of gambling advice that came out of Bobby's mouth was not true, all the product of...
Not Bobby's mouth.
Yes.
Our hero's mouth.
Yes, our hero's mouth was just gambling myths. And we learned a lot about, you know, the thought process. I found it very interesting about the backstory to the book.
I did too. What's happening on the various Wizard websites?
On Wizard of Odds, I just added a crazy four poker game that you can play. It will correct you when you make a mistake, and this is one of the many poker variants out there by Shuffle Master. This game has a very easy strategy, so if you're playing for comps, this game has a much higher house advantage than, say, blackjack and video poker, but you will earn comps a lot faster if that's what you want to do. So it's probably a good game of choice if...
What, like 2.5% or 3%?
Yeah,
or
I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's about 3%. Personally, I find Ultimate Texas Hold'em a much more fun game to play, but that game is, you also risk making mistakes in it, whereas Crazy Four Poker is as simple as three-card poker.
Very good. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else. In January, earning 3,500 video poker points during the month entitles you to a free logo jacket. If you earn 500 points on penny slots Saturday, Sunday, or Monday, you get to play Spin to Win game at your machine. It's possible to win up to 100,000 points, which is worth $300. These machines normally have a 8% hold, give or take, so the spins would need to average more than $40 to make this a positive play. While this is possible, I would want a lot more information about what others are getting before I decide to play that promotion. Very likely, there will be double points on New Year's Day, midnight to midnight. This has not been announced yet to my knowledge, but they have it every year on New Year's Day, so I'm planning to be there. The next semester of free video poker classes will begin at South Point on Tuesday, February 5th at noon in the showroom. We do not have the exact schedule worked out yet, but it will be a 10-week semester extending through April 9th. At the Palms, tomorrow and Saturday are the last of the $70,000 Greedy Grinch drawings at 7 p.m. I've been telling you about this for 4 weeks. So let me tell you about the one that's gonna you can start earning tickets for immediately after the Saturday night drawing. The January drawing is called the $100,000 Avalanche of Cash. The time for the drawings in January shifts to 8 p.m. every Friday and Saturday rather than the typical 7 p.m. time that's usual for the Palms. There'll be 15 cash winners every night, and the top five winners get entries into the January 26th drawing for a 2013 Chevrolet Avalanche, which in round numbers is worth $39,500, or you can get round numbers $31,500 as a cash equivalent. Sundays and Tuesdays remain double drawing entry day, with 40 ticket holders for the final drawing, which is five each night for the eight times. Each ticket is worth either slightly less than $1,000 or slightly less than $800, depending on whether or not you want to take the car or the cash. The PEW gifts play, earn, and win on Monday, Wednesday, Friday through December 30th, this coming Monday, are Visa gift cards at a rate of 0.20%. Beginning January 2nd, next Wednesday, the theme of the PEW gifts for the first half of the month is Blingin' the New Year. So some kind of jewelry or things. We have not seen the list yet, but rumors are that it's going to include at least one Visa card. The monthly contest at videopoker.com through the end of the month is Triple Play Dream Card. The most sensible game to play is Triple Double Bonus. Each round is 100 hands. So a dealt royal or dealt aces with a kicker pay 12,000 credits. As of this morning, 10th place was 22,000 and first place was 27,000, which means you basically need to get two dealt royals within 100 hands to have a shot to win. Good luck on that. Good. Now, next week, Michael's going to be off for the night for personal reasons, and substituting for Michael will be former co-host Richard Munchkin. Our guest will be Mark Billings, who will be talking about winning at roulette by identifying and exploiting biased wheels. Hopefully our audience knows that if you play roulette with a completely fair wheel, the house has either a 5.26% or a 2.70% edge, depending on whether there's one or two zeros in the layout. This sort of house edge can't be beat by playing fairly. But roulette wheels get old and out of alignment. Now, on these wheels, smart players who can identify these biases have an exploitable edge. Mark Billings will be talking about it next week. In 2 weeks' time, our guest will be Stanford Wong. I think this is his fifth visit here. He may be our guest with the most visits so far. Stanford is a renowned blackjack author in several other games. This time he's going to be talking actually about the Vegas real estate market and also about his current blackjack news and how that's changed over the years. All right. Now, Michael, last week you mentioned that you were playing on some bingo estimates. Do you have anything to tell us tonight?
Yes, I've been working hard on bingo lately. I wanted to add that in roulette, some wheels have a 1.35% house advantage if they have Correct. The European rule, where if you make an even money bet and it lands in zero, you get half of it back. They have these wheels, they're common in Europe, and the high limit rooms here in Vegas have them, although I tend to think that the ones here in Vegas are not biased, but maybe our guest next week can address that better than I can. So Keno, I mean bingo. Yes, this bingo is a huge undertaking because there's so many different places to play and times to play and promotions and different cards, and I'm trying to take it all in. And one of many questions that I want to address is, when should you play? In particular, what about the day of the week? And for years on my website, I've said that you should avoid playing on weekends because it's easy to see that there are a lot more players on weekends than on weekdays. And this is one of those times when I think that I might have been wrong, as I have been studying the number of cards actually in play. And between my own research and looking at the growth in cashball jackpots, which is available online, I don't think that there's a significant correlation between the number of cards in play and the day of the week. But then you may wonder, well, then how come there's so many more people on weekends? And I speculate it's different types of people. I think that on weekends you get more tourists playing, and I think that the tourist may typically only spend $20 on cards, which is not a lot. Whereas there are a lot of card hogging local players that just buy hundreds and hundreds of cards every time they play, and these players may be less inclined to play on weekends because they do see these crowds and think there's too much competition. But I'm going to continue gathering data on this and report back later if I still think it's true. You may be wondering, you know, how do I know? Is one thing you can do is look at the growth in cashball jackpots. These are driven by sales and validations.
And cashball jackpot is?
That is every session they will draw a ball at random. Say it's I-23, and then they will say if anyone gets a bingo on I-23, they will win the cashball jackpot, which could be anywhere from $500 to somewhere over $15,000 right now, but they're probably typically between $1,000 and $3,000. And the bingo parlors will take a certain percentage of all the sales of validation. And by validation, I mean that if you want to be eligible for this cashball jackpot, you have to pay extra for every card you buy to make it qualify for the cashball jackpot.
Usually $1 a card?
Yes, it's $1 a card or $2 a pack. And they put a percentage of all this money into the cashball jackpot. And this percentage, I might add, is pretty low, but I'll talk about that more in a future show. In general, I think that validating is a bad idea, by the way. I just don't think that it's a good value. And you might say, well, at some point it has to be a good value. But there are so many players out there that are jackpot chasers that I think that when a cashball jackpot gets really high, like into the five figures, it induces so much competition that it's just not worth playing.
Interesting. Do you are there any theories about, say, the day of the month, such as if Social Security, if people get Social Security checks on the first of the month, then you should avoid the first week when all the bingo playing grannies have money, and then at the end of the month when they don't have the Social Security money anymore, would that be a better time to play?
That's a good question. And as someone who worked for Social Security for 10 years, it's something I should have a good answer to. But I don't really have one right now, but I hope to in the future. When I worked at Social Security pretty much through the 90s, all the checks came out at the beginning of the month. And I know that the call centers were just really swamped right after checks came out with all kinds of complaints about where's my check or the amount is wrong and blah, 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 blah. And it was bandied around for years, we should stagger the checks. And as is typical in government, with a clearly good idea that had no downside, it took them decades to implement it, but they finally did. But what I'm not sure about is with everyone who is already currently on the rolls and used to getting their checks at the beginning of the month, did they just keep them there and stagger the new people, or did they stagger all the old people too? And I will write to one of my friends at Social Security to ask them. So I hope to have a better answer to that question on a future show.
I'm going to talk about something now that I have heard about, and I have not I've seen it, but I don't have great detail on it, but I think it's pretty exciting news for a lot of players. VideoPoker.com has released some iPhone and iPad games, including Quick Quads, which will correct you. So anybody who wants a portable Quick Quad game can get it through VideoPoker.com. They have it for iPad, iPhones, and Androids, I believe. So when Bob Nersesian was on the show several weeks ago, we went around, and it's probably not a smart idea to use these in the casino. But this is the first widely available tool to correct you when you're wrong with Quick Quads. And so Quick Quads is a popular game. And so if you want to learn to play it better and be corrected when you're wrong, this is an inexpensive way to get that information.
By the way, one thing my attorneys suggested I say on the show is that if you get thrown in jail for using Whiz Poker at the machines, don't come to me asking to pay your legal bills. You're on your own with that.
Uh-huh. So your attorney tells you to say that, but I suspect...
So I just said it.
but somebody could, well, I never heard him say that, so I'm going to... So we'll see. I hope you have good liability insurance.
Well, I have yet to hear of anyone even ask to put away something like a Whiz Poker or an electronic gadget to help you in video poker. Have you?
I've not heard of it. Which isn't to say it isn't going to happen. And when it does happen, I think I will hear of it. I'm enough connected to, in the video poker world that it will be posted somewhere that I will see or hear it one way or another. And when that happens, we will certainly send out the alarm. But I am not going to be the one who is the test case. Because I will not use them in a casino. Good luck. Hit lots of royal flushes. We'll see you next week. Good night, everybody.
Happy New Year.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel Casino and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.
Money.